We'll open the House Committee on Human Services on Friday, March 11th, 2011. As people who come to this meeting frequently, I make a point of starting on time, and we waited today hoping that more of our committee would be showing up this morning. Unfortunately, three of them, I think, will not be here. I think one is coming late, and Representative Gilliam is testifying on a bill on another committee, so he will be here in a few minutes. So with that, I'm going to open up the informational meeting on the reunification process. This issue came up in testimony earlier, and some of our representatives, members of this committee, had some questions about how it happens that children who are in foster care sometimes leave foster care and go back home, come into foster care, go back home, and it doesn't seem to be sometimes a successful process. So that was one of the reasons I wanted the committee to learn about how this happens, why it happens, and maybe what we can do better. I would also let you know that this meeting is being televised, and I will make sure that the people who are not on our committee will get a DVD of this, and it will also be available to other people who are interested in both of these issues regarding the foster home and reunification process and the state hospital and the state mental health program. So with that, thank you, ladies, for coming this morning.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I'm the Director for the Children, Adults, and Families Division and the Acting Director for the Department. Just appreciate the opportunity to be back. We understand our time this morning is limited, so I want to make sure just to hand it straight over to Lois to get to the issues, Madam Chair, that you described very well that you'd asked us to come back and speak to. This grew from the slide that we showed in our overview of the child welfare programs where we had a conversation about the fact that in 2010, 63% of our kids in foster care, they went home to their families, and we talked about the fact that at the same time that we're able, that is the pathway that most of our children take out of foster care, and that we have data that we're actually quite proud of as we've been reducing foster care that shows that children who have been hurt and then are hurt again, the number of those incidents, we call it our reabuse rate, is actually improving. So the number of kiddos getting hurt again, it has gone down dramatically in the last several years. And also the number of kids who reenter foster care has gone down quite a bit over the last several years as well. But we do understand that for those kids for whom that isn't true, that's a very serious thing, and we take that very seriously. So we appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk more with you about the process, how decisions are made, who makes the decisions, and what those decisions are based on. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lois Day.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lois Day. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children in the Department of Human Resources. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to come address the issue of reunification to the committee. Co-chairs, I'd like to start with two concepts that impact reunification for children that are in the custody of the department. And the first is the concept of permanency. For children that enter the foster care system, we are required, with the exception of very few cases, to work with their parents for their reunification. And really, reunification is considered sort of the ultimate permanency plan. If we're able to successfully reunify a child with his or her parents and they can remain there safely, they're going to have a better chance of stability in life and outcomes that exceed those for children that enter the foster care system and don't leave the system. While we always identify an alternate plan to reunification for children, we are not allowed to implement that plan until we can demonstrate to the court system that reunification is not possible in a reasonable amount of time for the child. The second concept is that of shared decision making. To remove a child is not a decision the agency makes in the absence of others, and to reunify a child with their parent is not a decision the agency makes in the absence of others. When a child comes into foster care, within 24 hours, the court system is activated. Children are appointed attorneys. Frequently, there's a CASA appointed. Parents are either appointed or have the opportunity for attorneys. And, of course, the judge then weighs in on the decision-making of the agency. So I want to highlight that this is not a decision that a caseworker makes. It's not a decision that the agency makes in isolation of others. The The decision to use foster care is not a plan for a child. It's really considered a temporary safety service for a child. We don't intend it to be permanent, and it's used when we're unable to create a safety plan in-home with the parent that can be successful. Our goal is, with the reunification, is always to look to safety first and what plan can we create with the parent and those that surround the parent that allow the child to move back into the home. So removal is a safety decision and return is a safety decision. Reunification is not conditioned on successful completion of all services that are needed by the parent. But reunification is based on our ability with the parent to create an in-home safety plan that's sufficient to protect the child so the parent can resume parenting while completing services. In order to do that with the implementation of the Oregon Safety Model, we created what are called conditions for return. So with the removal of a child to foster care, what we know is that we can't create safety in the home, and so we have a conversation with the parent around the conditions of that safety that could not be met while the child was at home, and create conditions for return which outline specifically for the parent what conditions and circumstances need to exist in the home so that a safety plan can be maintained there. It's in writing. It's given to the parent. It's frequently incorporated in court orders. It's shared with all the parties that have the decision-making in that shared decision-making model around reunification. So everyone is aware of the conditions we believe need to exist for an in-home safety plan to be successful. Once the court system's activated, it isn't, again, simply our decision, but the court weighs in on that as well as the other parties involved in the system. After a child is returned, we don't close a case, and we don't leave the child there without a monitoring of that safety plan. We monitor it through face-to-face visits with the child. We have other people who are involved in the provision of services that also monitor that plan. And we have a service, a contracted services we're able to bring into the home called the ISRA services, In-Home Safety and Reunification Services, that I believe we spoke about before, that we can implement in the home to help elevate that durability, if you will, of that safety plan to enhance its chances of success. We also monitor parents' progress in service after a child is returned home, and we immediately respond when conditions may deteriorate, and we get notification of that to ensure safety of the child in that setting. If necessary, we will re-remove a child in order to preserve that safety. We can stay involved in a case for as long as necessary once a child is returned, to ensure all the parties that are involved that the child is safe. And the decision around when our case is closed is one that's made by the court, and the court has to vacate the commitment to us and terminate jurisdiction before that case can be closed. That said, last year we had a reentry rate in foster care of approximately 8%. So within 12 months of return to a parent, 92.7% of the children do not reenter the foster care system. The reabuse rate, as Aaron stated, is getting better. We've gone in the last couple of years from approximately 7% of children being reabused after return home within 6 months to slightly over 4%. And we attribute that in part to the elements of the safety model that have gotten very clear for our caseworkers around the issue of safety and the focus on safety when making decisions and working with parents with children in the home. So that's our sort of our reunification practice, if you will. And I'm certainly open to any questions or clarifications the committee might want.
Thank you, Lois. I appreciate that. Any questions?
Jim.
I mean, Representative Widener.
You can call me Jim. That's okay. As long as it's only you, Representative Tomei. I probably am going to have a few questions here because this is a very deep subject, and I think lots of times at the committee level, we stay on the superficial level and we really don't drill down into what's going on in the process. Do we take any age into consideration or attachment? Say if you have an infant child that mom's in prison for something, child's taken away with foster parent, foster parent's interested in adopting, that child only has attachment to that family and not to the mom. Are you going to lean on the side of giving the child back to mom when mom gets out of prison, or leaving the child in the environment if it's a stable environment and the family wants to adopt that child? Which direction are you going to steer the child towards? And is that a court issue?
I'm wondering if it is a court. We have at least one judge here, right? Maybe we should invite him up to give us a presentation. Would that make sense? I want to ask the panel here, does that make sense? Because it seems like a lot of those decisions are not made by the Department of Human Services. They're made by the court. Am I assuming that correctly?
The decision to return a child is one that when we have court jurisdiction, the child's committed to the agency makes recommendations to the court. The court either approves or does not approve that return home plan. So certainly we could speak to the attachment issue and decision making around that, and if Judge Fun would like to speak to the issue of the court's role, that would be excellent.
So go ahead, Loss, if you want to address that.
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, you raised the issue of attachment, and certainly for children who are in foster care with foster parents for the child is a prolonged period of time, we expect there to be and want an attachment to that foster parent by that child, because that's what creates healthy children, is their ability to attach. We're still obligated to work with the parent for return. The court makes a reasonable efforts finding of whether or not we're doing that. So I think that when a parent, let's say, is in prison in the scenario that you offered, what's important is that the child not meet the parent for the first time when they exit prison and we start working a reunification plan. I think it's the obligation of the agency to foster a relationship between that parent whenever possible through visitation and contact, so that that parent is not a stranger to the child. When a parent is incarcerated, that makes it more challenging. However, there are some programs in the state where we have visitation actually in the facilities, not all of them, and of course the location of incarceration will impact our ability based on the location of the child. If we still are in a position where we believe we can return that child successfully to the parent because they're able to maintain safety, completed their services, and parent the child, then the transition of that child from the foster home to the parent's home is particularly important, especially if there's been a long delay in the child knowing and having contact with the parent. So I would expect the agency to plan a slower transition, and one where hopefully the parent and the foster parent can actually have conversation and share information around the child, and then sort of slow reentry to the parent with increasing amounts of time. So what our focus is going to be on is successfully transitioning that capacity to attach by the child from the foster parent to the parent. You also raised the issue of adoption, and we do have quite a few foster parents who adopt the children who are in their care for prolonged periods of time. That is something that we support if there are not relatives identified who can adopt that child. However, until the court makes the decision that a return home is not reasonable within a time frame that's meaningful for the child, we're obligated to continue services to the parent and attempt to return.
Judge, I'm going to ask you to come up if you would, please. And maybe you could address some of the questions that Representative Widener has also, or talk about your role in both the child being in foster care and being returned home.
Good morning, folks. I'll just briefly...
Sir, could you give us your name first for identification purposes?
My name is Jim Fun, and I'm the presiding juvenile court judge in Washington County, Oregon. I just want to take an opportunity to address this question briefly, and then we'll just get back on track and talk more broadly. Representative, I will assure you that these questions are not straightforward, and they're oftentimes very, very complex. Everyone in court is sensitive and mindful to the relationship that children have with parents, relatives and family members. And the case law and statutes in Oregon are clear that the court and DHS is obligated to effect a return to the parent. And sometimes, depending on the circumstances, that can be challenging in the long term. But in the short term, DHS is obligated under Oregon law to make efforts to provide visits for the parent. And sometimes we supervise those visits therapeutically. And when a parent is in custody, for example, in a correctional facility, there is really good and robust efforts, I think, being made, at least on the local level, to ensure that those visits are productive, safe, and healthy for the child. Coffee Creek, for example, has programs that facilitate visits with parents, moms that are incarcerated, that are really quite productive for kids. And so, in short, we are in the beginning, in the middle, and end of the case, regardless of how it is resolved, very sensitive to that issue of attachment. That issue of contact and visitation is visited and revisited all the time in court at every single hearing. And I would add, finally, that I think that is a very productive process, because in the courtroom setting, all these complex issues can be discussed openly and, more importantly, transparently. Everyone has the opportunity to offer opinions, comments. The court has the ability to evaluate the perspectives of everybody, and I think the process works out really much better than people give us credit for, quite frankly. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative White.
It does. Are the laws loose enough to give you the ability to take in the child's rights ahead of the mom's rights at times? Or do you find that sometimes the way things are structured, you're having to put a child back with a parent when it may not be the right thing to do, but the way we've crafted things, you find yourself in that situation?
I'll just briefly say, I think sometimes the child's rights and the parent's rights are coexistent. The court process, for its faults, does several things, I think, that are really useful. Children have the benefit of attorneys, have the benefit of CASAs. Parents have the ability to have attorneys represent them in court. And so this process not only includes the perspective of the individuals, but the perspectives legally through their counsel and the CASA. And I suppose what I'd say is I can't answer your question in a specific sort of way, other than to say generally the best interest of the child is always a consideration in court. Is always a consideration. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Jess, why don't you stay up here a minute? And I know we have Walt Bigelow and Dick with. Now, Mickey, where are you? Did you want us to speak also? Okay. You're sort of introducing some of these folks,
yes.
Right? Okay.
For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. Very briefly, in 2006, 34 out of 36 local comprehensive plans from local commissions on children and families were presented to the state. And 34 out of those 36 said that child abuse neglect and abuse prevention was absolutely a critical issue in Oregon. The State Commission took from that that we needed resources in the community, and so we approached KC Family Programs, a national foundation, a large national foundation, to see how we could bring resources to Oregon to better support prevention efforts in communities, understanding that the community is where these kids and their families are served. We now have a partnership between the Commission on Children and Families, the Department of Human Services, the Judicial Department, and KC Family Programs that is called the Safe and Equitable Foster Care Reduction. And we have, since we began, and we actually began the partnership officially in January of 2009, hundreds of kids are being connected with safe family members, are prevented from entering the system, and are exiting sooner. And we have chosen to partner with 8 counties in the state that make up 75% of the children and youth that are in the foster care system. Today, it's a real pleasure to showcase 2 of the counties who are doing excellent work. We have Martha Brooks, the community member from Washington County, who is their community convener. And we have Dick Withnell, a community member who is the convener of the Marion County Commission and their foster care initiative. We also have Judge Jim Fun from Washington County and Walt Biglow, the district attorney from Marion County. So with that, I'm going to bring them up.
All right. Great. Thank you for coming today.
Guess I'll start. Chair, co-chair, my name's Dick Withnell. I'm the convener from Marion County, and also the chairman of Multnomah County. That's great. Yeah. All right. That's a Freudian slip, I guess. Yeah. Well, I love the comment of representatives saying that. Superficial level and drilling down. I'm probably the poster child about the foster care and the Department of Human Services, is that it was their problem of everything's going about, and it was the governor's problem or the representative's problems or the legislature's problem, everybody's problem, but my problem. And I had this realization that when we in our community were fighting methamphetamine, that we were very aggressive in 2005 and getting a handle on that. Through our public safety group and led by our district attorney here, then the unintended consequences happened, and that was the kids coming out of these homes. And then when I found out that it actually was the citizenry's responsibility on what are we going to do with these children, then we became very aggressive, and this is when Brian Johnson was still alive, became very aggressive on obtaining foster care parents in our community, and we asked the community to come forward with that, and we were able to develop that. I think it's important that the community realizes their responsibility, and we've been able to do that through the Commission on Families and Children, and particularly in our county, that we've had a broad-based support of that, and we've had all types of people on our commission that have stepped forward, giving foster care homes, respite care, and this has been led by an action team in our county by our district attorney, Walt Biglow. And I think that speaks volumes about what has been done in our county. This past 2 years, we've had the advantage of being one of the counties for the Casey Grant. And we've been able to move there's 7 goals, and you have that in front of you. We've been able to move the numbers on there the correct way the past 2 years. And under the leadership of Aaron Kelly Seal, we've been able to really be aggressive in improving those numbers. But again, my emphasis is, because I really represent the lay community, is that it's got to be bottom up. You have to have the community come alongside of the at-risk families and at-risk children, and we've been able to do it as well as these other 7 counties, as well as the other 36 counties in the state of Oregon. And this is where it is. The bottom line is that we can you know, we can huff and puff and we can, you know, we can point fingers at who's responsible, but if not the citizenry, the leadership of the community doesn't come together, then we're not going to solve the problem of at-risk families and children. And that's just my comments right now.
Representative, go ahead.
Thank you, Dick. You brought up a good point, and this was one I was going to get to later, but since you brought it up, I'm going to give it to you. The methamphetamine in children leaving. That's where I have troubles and where I think we really need to be looking at this reunification process is when a child is being taken from a drug home, parents end up in prison or come back, and then reunifying those children back into that home. I've seen situations where lots of times the parents are wanting the children back for the revenue rather than because of the children. That's why I brought up the scenario of an infant, because there is no bond between the mother and child at that point. What's the mother's reason for wanting the child back, and how closely are we looking at those issues? And with you being involved with this a long time, I'd kind of like to hear your comments on that and see if there's any holes or anything we're missing when we're doing this reunification process there that you've seen.
I can give you some really examples through the drug court here in when Judge Abernathy, she's not the juvenile judge court in court right now, but through the relief nursery here in Marion County, we've had the situation just as you explained, that was under court order, that the comment was made in March of that particular year that there was no way that these family would be reunified. And 9 months later, the words in the court was used, transformation of life, mm-hmm. because of being put together and under a controlled situation and being able to be led by, the, particularly in this county, as relief nursery family building blocks. So unless there is a set plan and a... and this is, you know, I'm just a business guy, but unless you have professionals come around surrounding this family and being able to work with them through an instrument like the relief nurseries, you will not have this transformation. And there can be a connection there. And the money saved, of course, is very significant, very significant. So I guess there can be reunification, but it has to be a lot of work to be done on that, and it has to be on the front end of it. Through the courts.
Thank you, Dick. Go ahead.
My name's Martha Brooks. I'm the state director for Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, but I'm here today as a citizen of the state and as the convener for the Washington County Casey Committee. We call ourselves a team. We work very hard together. We have a great team we've put together with the judge. I'm pleased to work with him. He's one of the drivers on our committee, and I have had over the course of time the pleasure of working with District Attorney Walt Begwell. You know, foster care is not something that any of us want to have to think about very often. But it is a reality, and so we need to do the best that we can do with the resources that we have, and oftentimes those resources are limited. But working with Washington County, the people that I work with, they do phenomenal work with limited resources, and fortunately, we are part of the Casey team. I commend Mickey for going out and getting the grant for us. I commend Erin for all the work that she's done with us. On my committee, I work with the top leadership in the Department of Human Services. So I have at my table, I have the top decision makers, I have the top people, and we've been able to shift that needle so that we do reunify parents. And I know Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Weinberg, that is not sometimes an easy issue. To reunify some kids. But we do try to do the best for them that we can. And sometimes mistakes are made. We can't hit the mark 100% of the time. But we do need to try and hit that mark more and more and more. And it's a tough deal, and I can tell you, I would not want to be doing some of the jobs that these people do. We work with, we have on our team, we have CASAs, we have community members. We had a community conversation with over 150 people in our community, not just in the Department of Human Services, but those outside. We had foster kids come to our summit, talk to us. We went back, we did a follow-up, and from that, we put together four committees that continue to work today on prevention, foster support, volunteer and donations, community awareness. We're working with listening groups on smaller areas such as African American population, Native American population, Hispanic population. And we're trying to reach out so that we can definitely touch on what their needs are, how we can work with them, that it's not DHS telling everybody what to do, but the families are involved, the communities involved. This is one of the greatest projects that I participate in as a citizen. I know that child abuse and neglect is not good. Walt and I work on that quite frequently together in another arena. And so I'm pleased and proud, and I know I'm going to let the judge talk about some of what we do. We do have some other things that we've got going on, and we think we're doing pretty good. We're moving the needle in Washington County.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I also have a pleasure of serving as the chair of our Family Preservation Action Team here in Marion County, which is under the umbrella of our KC team effort. As I was leaving the house this morning, my wife told me to speak with my heart today, and she didn't even know what I was doing today. But I'm going to do that because what we've really come to understand is that preserving family is our collective mission, and that our efforts and the objectives and the goals that you'll see listed in our KC plan really are an essential feature on a path to family preservation. So foster care is that road towards that goal of making sure families are healthy and safe. At Marion County, what brought us together was like paper and fire. And it was an amazing effort to bring Dick and his leadership in the community together to tackle the number one problem, is that we didn't have enough foster families, and that kids were spending their evenings in the cubicles at the Department of Human Services. And then as we jumped on top of this issue, we realized that we're not honoring and caring for and doing respite and supports to retain our foster care parents. So that was the birth of our foster care action team, very narrow focused. So once we brought the community together around that issue, we had a chance to take a little break and do a little self-analysis, and we realized that a broad, more comprehensive preventative approach was far more worthy of our effort to reach the goals that we had set forth. And I wanted to just kind of highlight some of those pieces collectively today with the efforts that you're seeing from two counties and counties across Oregon in themselves. And this is where the really heavy lifting exists. I was thinking about how we made this transformation, and it's like holding a huge, when you got a bigger umbrella, the wind is going to pull it more often. It's very difficult to keep those efforts in a comprehensive way together, but that's our focus now on the family preservation action team that we have pulled together in Marion County, keeping siblings together, keeping them in their local communities and near their schools, shortening their stays, bringing, for those families that are tougher to fix and find the solutions in the courtroom, the forever home concept, the concept of building aging out supports for kids that are older that have been through the process, finding more relatives. Those are the goals that we all recognize, and they come at the very front end, particularly at 0 to 5, and you'll see a lot of local efforts around that, trying to make sure that bonding occurs, and then that bonding allows us to inoculate those children against further challenges they're going to face later on, and hopefully address those core issues that those parents are facing. That's the intent. there were three things that made us have some small successes, I think. One, vulnerable families face enormous challenges. And so you have to have, you have to treasure them, and you have to build in community supports around them. Two, it takes, and we have, very talented and deeply committed people in Department of Human Services. I don't know if Billy Cordero is behind me, but that guy is representative of that belief in what you're doing around a family. In Catholic Community Charities, in the Children and Families Commission, in the faith community, in family building blocks, in the community, in the business community like Dick here today. And then finally, the catalyst for that is recognizing that you can't have institutional barriers between government guys like me and guys like Dick. And that's how you energize some of those that alignment and the mobilization of the preventative focus that you'll see in the charts here about outcomes, which we all know are very important in our building. And Dick and I aren't going to speak to these today. I'm confident people behind me don't want me talking about the charts here and messing that up. They speak for themselves. So just what's next? A couple key things I wanted to talk about. Safe families, short-term volunteer access for families that are not yet in foster care but are vulnerable. Healthy attachment, family building blocks, relief nursery concepts for that 0 to 5 to make sure that architecture of children in bonding with their parent is built and preserved long term. Looking at disproportionality, as Martha has suggested, is an extraordinary task and one that we're focused on. In your juvenile apartments, we're putting forth a crossover, trying to identify the relationship between kids that are in the dependency system but might end up in a delinquency as a youth charged with a crime later on, and what are the linkages there? And then you've talked a lot about coming out of prison or coming out of correctional setting. I was thinking of our efforts, not only statewide but locally, around children of incarcerated parents and those efforts to try and make sure that transition can work if we're actually going to reunite that child with their parent. And as you know, many of the people in our jails and prisons have children, extraordinary numbers of children. We've got to work through that one way or another, so there's a way to address that. So I appreciate the time today. I'm really pleased to be part of this panel here because I think it represents kind of the efforts at the front end in a more comprehensive way that we're trying to tackle the issue of reunification and kids and families. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And I think what is near and dear to my co-chair's heart and mine is the community involvement in all of this. That is very encouraging, and I think it was you who said that it has to come from the bottom up, that the community has to support these efforts, that we cannot expect that a state agency is going to be providing all the care and services and the wraparound care for these children. So we appreciate what you do. And just one more thing, Representative, I know you were a foster parent, and so was I. And so a primary importance here, of course, is the child, and we're hearing about the families, how important it is to get the children back to the families and support the families. But I think as a former foster parent, and maybe you feel this way too, that I remember when my first foster child left, I thought somebody had taken off one of my arms. Mm-hmm. It was so devastating. After that, it was somewhat less so. But I would hope, and I know that's true, that you do provide care and services for the foster families too, because it is wrenching when you lose that child. Mm. Representative, I don't mean to be stepping on your time.
That's okay. So, Dick, with you being a DA and everything, and knowing that your wife told you to speak from your heart, and I'm sure you're a parent as well.
It's Walt.
Walt, I mean, sorry, Dick, Walt.
Sure, his wife.
Walt.
Yeah. She reminds me every day, right?
So, well, maybe Dick wants to be a DA someday.
Yeah.
It sounds like things have changed quite a bit in the system. And I'm just wondering, at times when you're prosecuting or if you're involved in one of these cases and you have the parent who is a drug addicted parent, and with having children you know how stressful they can be. I wonder if sometimes are we looking closely at, okay, we're going to reunify these kids with this mother, father, or single parent. She has 5 kids. One of them she hasn't even met before, but we're going to put them all back with her. I have 4 boys. 2 of them are out of the house now, and 2 are still at home. And just having 2 at home, sometimes it could almost drive me to drink. So with them battling and fighting, I wonder, are we taking that into consideration, what's best for the mom as well, because, or the dad or whoever's taking them, when we put all these children back and they're trying to get themselves clean and sober or whatever they're battling on the addiction side, are we making the right choice when we reunify them within a year back with that parent who's trying to get their life straightened out? Because they haven't learned structure themselves, how to do things in a manner. The children need structure. What kind of oversight are we bringing into the system now? And do you think we may do that too quick? Because you're the one who's defending a lot of this stuff, so you deal with it day in and day out, Walton. I would like to hear your opinion on that.
Sure. Co-chair Tomei, Representative Wiedner, am I saying your name correctly?
Wiedner.
Wiedner, I'm sorry. I should know that with the EI and being German.
German, yes. I can give you some jokes off the record with that. So,
I won't candy coat this. Some of these family situations are extraordinary, and we fear that we won't be able to make it happen. I think that time is very, very important, because to wrap around the community resources and to involve the direction of the court and those expectations does take time to address those core challenges that that woman with an addiction issue and 5 kids faces. And so our greatest ally is building that support around them and making sure that that we give the appropriate time for that that woman to come to a place and time where she can handle those situations. And it's really a comprehensive approach. You've got to have all the different pieces in place before you'll see success. We don't always succeed. We do see these families come back, and that's the frustrating part in the courtroom and and for the players, for all of us as we do this. And in some cases, the fact is, it's not going to work. We all need to own that, and we have the capacity to manage that as well. But I don't know if that directly answers your question, but there's a little bit of the support building and hope that we can make sure that once again this person can parent. And we have seen these successes. I have, in our drug court here, I've seen the woman with 5 kids who came in, who was in shackles, meth addicted, flopping from one house to the next with those kids, and able to break with those supports, with mentoring, substance abuse treatment, and the leadership of the court and the team around them, to break out of that, become to a point where they can acknowledge that they love their kids and their kids need them, and then we can lead them down that path. And that does occur, and there are many examples of that across across the state. But it's just really hard work, and I think we need to have confidence that we can make it work. And when we can't make it work, we need to accept that too and move forward into a different place. And one of our efforts here is to promote adoptions. And we've done really, really well in many counties around making that final decision and heading down that path.
Judge, do you have any last words, sir?
I do. I have a very brief statement, and I want to use our time wisely. So any questions that you folks have for me afterwards, I invite it. So with that, Madam Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Vice Chair Thompson, Representative Wiedner, and other committee members, thank you very much for your attention. My name is Jim Fun. I'm the presiding Washington County Juvenile Court judge. I was invited, of course, by the Commission for Children and Families to comment on our work regarding the reunification and permanency process of the Safe and Equitable Foster Care Reduction Initiative signed by the Chief Justice and Governor Kulongoski. More directly, my comments, of course, reflect my personal experience in Washington County and do not reflect the position of the Oregon Judicial Department or my colleagues individually. Our shared goal of equitably and safely reducing the number of children in foster care has been collaboratively embraced in Washington County. The seed planted by the Casey Foundation is one of the eight Casey counties, has really in Washington County resulted in a forest of fresh ideas, and most importantly for us, raised expectations of what is possible and realistic. The collaborative partnership in Washington County, started by the Casey Foundation, involves, of course, Casey, the Commission on Children and Families, DHS, CASA, nonprofit treatment programs, and the juvenile court. We have worked to safely and permanently reduce the number of children in foster care in a dramatic way, I think. And more importantly, that opportunity for a well-meaning and resourceful community to build on its strengths has been promoted and fostered. Most broadly stated, Representative Wiedner, the purpose of the child welfare system is the relentless pursuit of a safe and permanent family for every child. We started with that vision, and embraced by our community partners is that relative or family friend placement would result in better outcomes for all of our children. So we worked hard to have better relative and family friend engagement. Mindful of the current existing laws and rules which require and obligate DHS and the court to make diligent efforts to place children with a relative or family friend, we worked to define ways in which, given the demographics of our county, our practices and resources, that we could supplement that effort. To highlight just a few of our most visible efforts.
Judge, I'm sorry to halt this, but it sounds like you have written testimony here. Could I invite you maybe to give that to our staff, and we will share it with everyone on the committee?
Great.
I have another hearing that should have started 25 minutes ago, and I'm feeling the press of time. So I really appreciate coming here. I think we may have still more questions, and I would hope that maybe Representative Wiedner, that you'd be able to contact some of these people, or they can contact you. I think you may still have some questions that you would like to have answered.
Well, Mickey's actually from my district, so I'll just go knock on her door.
Terrific. Good. That's great. And I really appreciate you all coming today and being willing to come to testify and share your time with us. Thank you so much. And if you could give your statements to the staff, or give this young man, Matt, over here.
I'll make sure that clean copies are made available.
Wait a minute. I've been told.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I want to thank you, and I want to thank our colleague for helping us focus on this issue. Every single person that's testifying, starting with the department and then this panel, has reinforced the difficulty of this situation, but more importantly for me and for us, reinforced the fact that we can do something about it.
Yeah.
Whether it's from it's not us against them, it's whether it's from folks who are serving in public service or folks who are in the private sector or volunteering. This is, in a strange way, very encouraging to me, and I want to thank everybody for coming. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. With that, I will close the informational hearing on the reunification process and open up the informational hearing on the state mental health, which will also include the state hospital. We have a list of people coming to testify, and I'm going to change the list. Richard, would you come up first? And Greg Roberts, would you come also, please? Is Maggie Bennington-Davis here? Okay. All right, good. I couldn't see you, Maggie. Sorry. Okay, but I'm not calling you up yet. So, colleagues, today we're going to have Mental Health 101, and we're just going to have we're not going to be getting down into the weeds in this, but we'll be hearing about how the state mental health programs are working, especially the state hospital, but also we have people here from the community mental health programs. And so we'll be, yes, Representative Thompson.
In this context, I would really like to hear some statements, too, about where we are with the Junction City Hospital. I keep hearing one person telling me that it's going to be dropped, the next person telling me it's absolutely going to be built, and I want to hear something on where we are with that project. And
I'm not sure anybody here can tell you.
Well, if you can, I'd like to hear some comments on that subject on the record.
Okay, I can appreciate that. That is not what I've asked people to talk about today.
We have the right people here. So.
Okay, so if I don't mean to put you on the spot, Richard, but whatever you can tell us, that would be helpful. Okay.
Good morning, Committee Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam and members. My name is Richard Harris. I'm the Director of the Division of Addictions and Mental Health in the Oregon Health Authority. So I have come prepared today, along with Superintendent Roberts, to talk about the basic mental health system and how addictions and mental health are delivered across the state. And I'm happy to do that. I'm also happy to address questions and issues around Junction City. It's the matter of how much time we have and what order you would prefer to proceed
right.
in. So I will take the committee's direction on this.
Okay, Richard, I appreciate that. We have quite a few people coming to testify today. And I know that at least one person, I don't know, Representative Widener, I know at least one person has a commitment at 10. How much do you have? Can you stay beyond 10?
No, I'm good.
Oh, good. Okay, terrific.
I need to hear Representative Hoyle and what she has to say.
Right, and I do too. Richard, you have a lot of information here. I think we're not going to be having enough time to be going through all of this. Maybe you can just sort of give us a quick overview of how the state deals with mental health.
I would be glad to do that, Chair
Tomei.
So I would say that the subject matter for the state and addictions and a mental health division within the Oregon Health Authority is to understand that we're dealing with a chronic disease of both addiction and mental illness, and that chronic disease by definition recognizes that it requires management by the individual of that disease and pretty much over a lifetime so that it's not like a broken arm where you might get a cast and the arm would be healed and then you'd be on with life. These are health problems that exist that do require a lifelong care. And so the models for care and treatment really have to follow that precept. One in four families are really affected by addictions, and about roughly the same number with people with mental illness. Actually, the number of people with addiction problems are really someplace around 1 in 10, so it's not like every individual has a problem, but it affects so many people because of family, coworkers, jobs, and so forth that the number really is much bigger in terms of the impact in the communities and how we end up having to deal with these issues. The focus, though, for the state is really on the segment of the population of individuals who are exhibiting chronic conditions and are very serious conditions. And that doesn't mean that all of us don't have days where we're feeling depressed. We have episodes of anxiety or different kinds of problems like that, but they don't debilitate our activities. They don't actually consume our lives. And the state really ends up having the responsibility for those individuals where these diseases have progressed to the point where they're very serious, get in the way of their functioning. And, of course, for individuals that don't really have the resources at the level where they can just use their private insurance to go to a treatment program. So when we look at who we're really responsible for, it's a system of care for addictions and mental health that are statewide, that require the partnerships of people in the local community and have the active involvement of the county mental health and addiction authorities in every county in the state, and a variety of providers, many of whom are nonprofit organizations. In fact, there are over 400 of them that are delivering mental health and addiction services, and those services are everywhere from a foster placement to group homes to residential facilities to secure residential facilities, detox centers. There are a variety of treatment programs across the state that are operated in the communities for people, by and large, who are in those communities. So you have to envision the state office is responsible to develop contracts and provide licensure and certification and to help communities figure out and solve problems that are local to the community, but it's the communities that deliver the service. In the case of addictions and mental health, the communities are the primary focus for and contact point for the individuals we serve. So I wanted to just sort of skip forward a little bit. I think if we go to slide four, you could see roughly that most of the services provided to people are in communities, that we touch about 161,000 lives across the state in 32 community mental health programs, and there are nine mental health organizations that act as managed care entities along with the counties to provide these services. And then there are two state hospitals. Greg will talk about the hospital here in Salem. But there's also a hospital in Pendleton called Blue Mountain Recovery Center. But in total, those two hospitals serve about 1,400 people a year. And those are individuals that really weren't able to acquire the kinds of services they needed to stabilize in the community and needed to be in a facility that was equipped to deal with their issues. And Greg will talk more about who is actually in the hospital and what their concerns are. If you go to slide five, this is really a slide that's intended to sort of give some perspective to the extent of the problems in the state. So if you look and see that we have a lot more people who, in our prevalence studies, we update a prevalence study every year, and then we can see how many people have a serious addiction and mental health problems and how many people we're actually serving. So,
Representative White, do you have a question?
Yes, real quick. On these here on page five, Richard, how many of these do you think cross over? So between addictions, mental health, you have problems, gambling, so how many of those cross over into each other? We have total numbers, but a person who's suffering with addictions probably has some mental health issues or has a problem gambling, may have an alcohol addiction as well. So how much of that is crossover in these numbers?
Representative Widener, Chair Tomei, and Gilliam, this is kind of a debate that goes on in the field. I believe that what you'll find is that there are, it's not sort of either or. Many people have perhaps more serious mental illness and less serious addiction problems. In fact, they may be using drugs and alcohol to self-medicate. And so is that really an addiction issue or is that a mental illness? The same goes on the side of addicts. There are many people with addictions who have chronic depression and would exhibit various symptoms of mental illness. The answer, I think, is that probably well over half of the individuals have co-occurring conditions that go back and forth. In fact, we have programs that are designed really around treating individuals who have major co-occurring disorders. And, of course, there are many other health problems that coexist with both of these populations, so that the health disparities that these individuals have are very high. So the health of these of people that fall into the categories of mental illness or addiction are very serious. And so my argument has been, as we've been going through health transformation, is we need to be attending to the total health of these individuals and not just see them in a bucket over here as, oh, you have an alcohol problem, so therefore you only need to go to alcohol treatment or get into AA or recovery group. The problem is just bigger than that. And I think that what compounds it all is that we have many people who we don't get to see because of the resources that are not universal. You can't just walk into any doctor's office and get treatment for addiction or mental illness as well. So I think the issue of how many people we see and what the prevalence and what the disorder is pretty complicated. I just know we're not serving enough people, and we have to figure out better ways to serve them. And I think the chart on the page five, is really designed to show us how far we are penetrating into the treatment of what the need is. If you go to page six, the reason I brought this for you is because we're actually losing ground, and that, to me, is not the way we should be going. We're able to serve fewer of the individuals. There are more individuals this year than when we did this last year in terms of the need, and our funding, which has been reduced pretty steadily for some time, particularly since 2003 cut in the health plan, is that we're serving fewer people rather than more people, and we need to find a way to reverse that trend. So I wanted to talk just a bit about where the money comes from. So I realize this is not the Ways and Means Committee, but I think it's important to understand what foundation the system is on. And as you can see on page 7, we have a lot of general fund that's invested in mental health and addictions. We have a lot of federal funds. This chart does not show, however, the total extent of the federal dollars. So in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, there is about $625 million in federal funds that are also going to help this population deal with their health problems. So this is not the total budget. You'd have to include a portion out of that Office of Medical Assistance Programs. But roughly, we get Medicaid dollars that flow through AMH, and we also have block grant funds from the federal government for both addictions and mental health. Lottery funds is a really small amount. It is tagged and dedicated to providing gambling treatment. And the other funds are some beer and wine tax money that flows through AMH. You may not know this, but a lot of the beer and tax money, wine money, goes back through the counties directly, and also it's split up in a variety of different ways. And the part that goes through our budget is pretty small. So that's where the money comes from. And the way it is spent is on page 8. So of the total $958 million, the state hospital represents 38% of that general fund or the total funds budget. The mental health programs in the community and the alcohol and drug programs are the represent the about 50%, 55% of the total funds. And the program support that includes a number of special programs that are funded out of our office amounts to 4% of the expenditures. If you go to page 9, and I know we'll end up talking about this during the legislature at some point, and certainly it's an issue, is that most of the employees in the Mental Health and Addictions Division work in the state hospital system. There are about 118 people that work in my office, and we're currently working with 23 vacant positions as a result of previous reductions over the last year. And so we're a fairly small workforce. And most of the individuals who work for the state of Oregon are hospital employees, and Greg will talk some more about that as we go forward. Wanted to, if you turn to page 10, I think the way I would like to approach this discussion is, what are the opportunities to increase the number of people we're serving, to be more efficient in what we're doing? And I believe that there are a variety of things that we are doing now. Some we can do a better job of in the future. And then, of course, we are having a concurrent discussion about healthcare transformation that is going on as part of the governor's effort to change the way we deliver healthcare. And a number of committee members, your committee members, are on that healthcare transformation. Representative Thompson and Representative Greenlick are active in that effort. Our division believes that it's a very large plus for mental health and addiction services to have an integrated delivery, a care delivery system, so that people can get the level of health care they need and get the right amount of treatment for their mental health or addiction issues. I think the use of peer and consumer-driven services is an important part. In the A&D system, there are many people in recovery who actively work there. Peers are an essential part of the delivery system. On the mental health side, not so much, but that's the direction we're moving in. We believe that's not only a more effective way to deliver services, but it also helps reduce and contain costs. I think and I'll talk just briefly about a couple of programs that are really geared up to intervene earlier to prevent people from going into more expensive chronic conditions, and I'll go through that in a moment. Representative Widener, the other day when we were talking about the Alcohol and Drug Commission, you had asked a question about what you thought the most effective programs were to Dr. Goldberg, and I wanted to come up here and answer the question. So at some point I would be glad to sit down with you and go through that if you were interested, because I think there are some very effective things that we do and that we recognize in most of our treatment programs that it's important to take advantage of a 12-step recovery, and I think probably in every alcohol and drug treatment program in the state, there's some element of 12-step program that's attached to those programs. Of course, they're independent. They're not in the program, but they're a vital part of how people stay in recovery, how they prevent relapse, and how they manage their disease.
Richard, we're not going to have time to go through each of these. Can you sort of highlight some of the issues you really want us to...
Well, you just heard from the previous testimony here how important it was to intervene with parents and of who have addiction issues. And I didn't hear all the testimony, but the ITRS system, which is a combination of children and families in partnership with local providers, addresses the treatment issues of families so that you can keep them from going into foster care. And slide 11 talks about how much money that really saves the whole foster system if you get families reunited. That program is a very effective program. And one of the, I would say one of the smartest things the state did was to fund that program several years ago, and it's showing good results. The ESA programs, which is another early intervention program for young people who are exhibiting symptoms of psychosis, and the idea here is that you surround in a wraparound way those individuals with all the services they need early on so they don't progress into more serious mental illness and schizophrenia, and it has shown remarkable results as well. Unfortunately, this is only in 16 counties across the state. We want to make it statewide, and that would be certainly a priority for my office. So that's on slide 12 and 13. I think we're moving forward with an adult mental health initiative called Aim High. I won't go into that one. I would love to talk about this at some point because it's a major change in the way we manage mental health services. It's following the changes that we made a few years ago in the kids' mental health system, and it is proving to be successful in shortening length of stay in residential programs and integrating a mental health outpatient and residential program. So with that, which I don't think I can talk any faster.
You did a great job, Richard, and I appreciate it.
I would turn that over to Greg Roberts.
And I know you have a lot more to say, and we want to bring you back, and I especially want the committee to hear about Aim High.
Madam Chair, may I give them one little question?
Of course.
Okay, it might not be too little, but...
little.
Little. therapeutic homes. Some of the counties are using them, some of them aren't, and I know the state uses them. Do you think they're a positive thing? And that, to me, it seems like a very good thing in a direction we should be heading, but I'd like to hear your opinion on them.
You know, this is Representative Widener, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam. I'm not familiar with that program. I don't think it's one that we're actively using in our system. So I have to confess ignorance to this.
Okay.
So maybe we can find somebody who will be testifying from the community of mental health who will be able to help us there.
Representative. One second, Madam Chair.
Sure.
It was indicated to me that Representative Hoyle, who's here now, would not come unless there were treats for everyone. I have them. I'm going to distribute them. Please keep going. I'll be minimally interactive.
You're going to...
I've got them. Just keep going.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Greg, thank you for coming. Thank you so much, Richard.
Good morning, Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam and committee members. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. I'm from New Jersey, so I can talk really fast, and, even with a slight accent. I've been the superintendent at the hospital now for 6 months, and I'm happy to be here again at the committee to report on basically a status report about the hospital for the committee and answer any questions. I'm starting on slide number 16, and for an important reason. I've been going around the state recently speaking to the Oregon Psychiatric Association and to NAMI groups, and the name of the speech more recently is Why the Future of the State Hospital is Brighter Than You May Think, because it is. And for that reason, we chose to begin this presentation with slide number 16, because for a good part of the 6 months that I've been at the hospital, we've been focusing on the readiness of the hospital for positive change. And we have what we call the Hospital Excellence Project. The Kauffman Global Consultants are assisting us with certain parts of that following the Liberty Healthcare Report findings. And recently, as part of a two-day retreat, including the leaders of the hospital, we have asked ourselves how we see the future. What is our mission? What is our vision? What if we close your eyes and try to envision the hospital a few years from now? What would we want the hospital to be? What would we want it to be doing? So the vision and mission statement have been recently developed and clarified, and I think say exactly what we expect the hospital to be a hospital, a psychiatric hospital that inspires hope, promotes safety, and supports recovery for all of the patients. I want to mention the word recovery. I know everyone's heard that, and it's used quite a bit in the field these days. It's an important fact that recovery from serious mental illness is not only possible for a person. Research clearly demonstrates it's more than likely for most people with serious mental illness. So we assume that. for all of the patients who are admitted to Oregon State Hospital, no matter what their situation is or how ill they may be, recovery is more than likely, and our job is to facilitate that recovery so the person can be discharged successfully back to the community. So then the mission derives more specifically from the vision to say that our mission is to provide therapeutic, evidence-based, patient-centered treatment focusing on recovery and community reintegration, and to do all of that within a safe environment. So this has helped focus the staff at the hospital at all levels. We're emphasizing this everywhere and externally as well to our consumers and other stakeholders to convey a clear sense of how we see the business of the hospital proceeding. Slide 17 is just meant, again, to reiterate things you've seen before, to remind people about the various populations served at the hospital, for people who are civilly committed, people who are geriatric or with serious medical conditions, and then the largest part of our population are forensic patients, either guilty except for insanity or sent to the hospital for evaluation or restoration of their ability to aid and assist in their defense. Page 18 gives you the specific statistics on that. The two left columns there give you the current breakdown of the population, and the two right-hand columns give you a summary of 2010, how many people were served in the hospital throughout the year. And I think one thing to notice there, if you'll see that currently 58% of our population are in the GEI, guilty except for insanity, category. It's a lower percentage treated through the year because the aid and assist population, which is currently only 16%, was 33% of the people served in the year. What that indicates is that the aid and assist population come into the hospital and leave the hospital. They return to correctional settings. They come into the hospital, as I said, to be restored to the ability to assist in their defense. So that's the explanation of the difference in the percentages that's been raised before.
Just a second. I just wanted to call your attention to that. I mean, that's a huge, it's 74% of the patients in the hospital, yeah, if I'm reading right. This correctly, are either because they have been found guilty except for insanity, or a crime had been committed and they are in the hospital for aid and assist until they're well enough to be able to go on trial. Am I correct in sort of summarizing
correct.
That? So, I mean, that's a startling statistic that we need to be aware of. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great PowerPoint presentation. Sounds wonderful. But I want to drill a little deeper. Are we setting work plans for each one of these patients? Are we following up on the work plans? Are we monitoring to see how the patient's responding to the work plan that we give them, and setting goals to get them out of the hospital, or are we just kind of letting them do what they want? But are we putting together a structure in place for them to work on getting better in the hospital?
Representative Widener and co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, it's the perfect lead-in to my favorite slide, which is slide 19. I would talk about that in terms of achievements, things that have occurred already at the hospital, and relating to some future vision. But the future vision that I'll be talking about is immediate future. We're not going to be talking about things that are not going to be happening for another year or two. And your question has to do exactly with a starting point of that. So let me just refer to this slide. The starting point, the answer to your question, has to do with what we refer to as person-centered treatment planning. Every patient at the hospital has a treatment plan. They're served on a unit or a ward that has a interdisciplinary treatment team, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, social workers, nursing, rehab staff, etc. Those teams put together plans with the patient's input for the person's recovery, starting with a question as to where does the patient want their life to go, where do they see their strengths, what would they like to be engaged in, what type of programming. To jump ahead a little bit on your question, the patients then receive treatment on their programming on, for the most part, on treatment malls. These are centralized areas of the hospital that where patients leave their unit, leave their ward to go for the majority of their day to attend programs, and ideally those programs are linked to the treatment plan that the patient helped develop. That's a work in progress. We have started on that process. We're training our staff in the methodologies of person-centered treatment planning, and then we're working now to connect the treatment plans to the programs on the malls, and all of that should be discharge-driven. So the goal, a state psychiatric hospital anywhere in the country these days, that's our job, to have a person admitted because they can't be served in the community, but to help restore that person to stabilization enough that they can then return successfully to the community. So everything we focus on these days is on the treatment plan being well done and then implementing that plan on treatment malls. Of our current population, a little less than 600 patients, and I think we're in the 580s today, 524 patients attend treatment malls every day. And for many for the majority of their day.
And Representative, what I'd like to do sometime is set up a field trip for us to visit the new state hospital. I haven't visited the new one. I've visited the old one several times. So I think it would be...
Representative Thompson stealing my donuts.
I'm sorry. Okay, we're going to move to the last slide, which I think is an important one, again, for us to be aware of the annual cost of care.
Number 20?
Okay. Yes, please.
Yes, these figures have been requested, I think, especially by Representative Greenlick in the past, to show the annual cost of care at the various hospitals, Blue Mountain and Pendleton. You'll notice there are different rates, annual rates, for the different populations representing, to a great extent, I think, the intensity of the care and treatment
right.
that people require. So.
And, Greg, could you talk some about, my understanding is that all the care that happens in any of these state hospitals is fully funded by the general fund, but the care in the community residential areas, there are federal funds also available for those. Is that correct?
Representative Tomei and members of the committee, not 100%
okay.
True. The large majority of the funding for the hospitals is general funding, but there is also federal reimbursement and sometimes private insurance that we generate.
We're able to generate
billable services.
And
yes.
So maybe that would be good for us to get those figures in the future also.
Sure.
But then the community residential facilities, part of that can be reimbursed by Medicare and Medicaid. Is that correct?
Representative Tomei and committee, I'm no expert on that, but that's generally my understanding. That's
and we'll
true.
Find somebody yes. here who maybe can give us that. Thank you so much, and I appreciate you coming, and I'm sorry that we've had to rush through this so quickly. And if you wouldn't mind staying in the audience, I think there might be other questions. Thank you so much. And I'm going to call up Maggie Bennington-Davis, who was co-chair on the State Hospital Advisory Hospital Board. And I think Gina Nickel, who is with the Association of Oregon Community Health Programs. Gina's here? Yes, there she is. Great. Go ahead, Maggie. And as you're aware, we're going to have to stop at 10 because people have other meetings. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I may need to sneak out for a transportation conference call. They were supposed to set it up for 10, and it looks like 9:30, and they keep hounding me here about that. Sorry about that.
I appreciate you coming in, and if you can come back, that would be wonderful.
I'll shoot back down as soon as it's done, but it's some guys on the East Coast that...
They don't know what 9:30 East Coast time is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think my staff might be part of it, too. So.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Okay, Maggie, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, co-chair. Thank you for this opportunity to address you. My name is Maggie Bennington-Davis. I am a psychiatrist. I work for Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. And today I am addressing you on behalf of the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. The advisory board is charged by you, the legislature, to advise you and the staff of Oregon State Hospital on matters concerning patient care and safety in the state hospital. And the advisory board takes that charge very seriously. and the members of the advisory board have not come lightly to the matter before you today, which is pretty explicitly about the building of Junction City Hospital, as Representative Tomei had asked for me to bring forward the advisory board's comments on that. However,
Becky, I'm sorry, I need to respond to that. Actually, I knew that was going to be part of the conversation, but really what I'd like you to do is talk about the advisory board and the process that the advisory board has gone through the last couple of years. And I know you have 4 pages of testimony here.
So there's a lot there, and it's, as I was just going to say, this is all knitted together. You really can't talk about one part of the system without talking about other parts of the system. So I'm going to be touching on the community mental health system that Richard did a great lead into, as well as the process the advisory board has used to come to the recommendations today. The advisory board has had the opportunity to talk at length about the community system, including the state hospital, as part of that system over the last almost a year. And during that time, we've investigated all the material that has been made available to us and in quite some depth. We sent a letter to the legislators on January 20th and did want to explicitly move forward to you a recommendation that the building of Junction City is not a good idea at this time. And then the reasons for that really grow out of our concerns about the community mental health system as a larger entity. The advisory board really questions the need for more state hospital beds at a time when the original master plan back in 2005 recommended the development of a robust community system, and that has not happened. The master plan clearly states that successful planning requires community resources and development beyond what currently exists. And so far, we've just failed to do that. And in fact, we've been getting some visits from the Federal Department of Justice looking at just those aspects of our system and really questioning with us where the holes are in our community mental health system. Until we do create a robust community mental health system, there will never be enough state hospital level beds. And when we do create a robust community mental health system, we will find that we already have more state hospital beds than we need. Nearly every other state in this country, with the exceptions of Nevada and Oregon, have figured this out, and we have the singular and unwelcome status of being pretty much alone in building more beds instead of investing in community-based treatment. Richard said we need to find a way to serve more people, and it should be a startling statistic to us all that 38% of our budget is spent on 1,400 of the 160,000 people currently receiving mental health services. And as Richard himself said, there are many people we're not getting to at all. I'm a physician, and as such, I'm very proud to live in a state that is led by a physician. And furthermore, I'm proud that Governor Dr. Kitzhaber is focused on prevention and early intervention as really the only means of decreasing health care costs and improving health outcomes. And mental health in this regard is no different from physical health. The failure to invest in low-end, inexpensive, community-based early detection, access to early treatment, inevitably results in the need for high and expensive, less likely to succeed long-term hospital level of care for conditions that really tend to become more and more chronic within the state hospital walls. And that's an issue that the advisory board has really grappled with, this idea that somehow being in the state hospital itself leads to more and more problems and more severe problems. And we'd like to see that trend reversed. The Office of Addictions and Mental Health recently released an updated forecast regarding the need for state hospital beds. And that, I've got just one copy of it. If you haven't seen it, it's out of the Office of Addictions and Mental Health. The updated forecast, one of the statements in it is that standalone facilities and communities cannot provide the robust treatment necessary for people to learn to live independently. That's a quote from their report. And that institution-based care can do a better job of that. And that is just a completely outrageous statement, and it is patently untrue. And it really flies in the face of the vision of our new governor, a vision that the advisory board believes in. We understand now that the drumbeat is that Junction City facility is meant to be a replacement facility for two of the other campuses, the Portland campus of Oregon State Hospital and the Blue Mountain Recovery Center. But we challenge and, in fact, disagree with the assumptions that those beds need to be replaced if, indeed, they are closed, because if community services were robust enough and if we hadn't lost through budget cuts and the move to fee-for-service low-end services like supported employment, supported education, assertive community treatment, community integration supports, early psychosis, there would, in fact, be a decided decrease in the need for necessary beds. And even if those beds are necessary for now, and we are, until we are able to increase community services, and by the way, we've already increased beds at the Salem campus through the new building, but the advisory board disagrees that a new building in a geographically undesirable place located on the Department of Corrections land next to a criminal facility is superior to remodeling a building in the most populated part of the state, namely Portland, where families reside, education for people while they're in the hospital is accessible, and work for them while they're in the hospital is available, where staff are more likely to be found, and also in the far east part of the state that's so far from any other resources. So we challenge the idea that remodeling is, in fact, not a good idea. We're furthermore really concerned about the operating costs that have been projected for Junction City, because we believe that those operating costs are likely to come right out of the pockets of what we could do a better job with in the community. The operating costs are projected to be $101 million a year for that facility, and that's $39 million a year more than we're currently spending. But even at that, we suspect it's a low figure. And just to put that in a little bit of context, you heard Richard say he'd like to expand the early psychosis project, which the advisory board would fully buy into. To expand that to the entire state, everywhere it needs to go, would cost under $3 million. So when you put it in the context, and it would reach a lot more people than 172 people.
Maggie, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to brush you up a little bit. I have quite a few people here.
I have just about two more minutes, and then I'm going to turn it over to Gina. I also want to point out that the new forecast emphasizes the use of population-based information as opposed to history-based information. But frankly, neither method of projecting the need for a state hospital is a sufficient method, because there are so many tremendous and overwhelmingly moving pieces in the system that we have no history with and no present with and no population from which to extrapolate. So I'm going to run through these four things very quickly. It'll take me about 2 minutes. One was already mentioned, AIM High, which stands for the Adult Mental Health Initiative, which is pushing people through the state hospital and residential system in an unprecedented manner and pace, and it's already outstripping its own first-year goals, even 6 months into it, and that was not factored into the forecast. Number two are the changes in PSRB. You heard that 74% of the people in the state hospital currently are either under PSRB or aid and assist. There are already practical changes that are occurring at both the front door of the state hospital and the back door that are decreasing the utilization of the hospital by those populations. And there's further legislation that will come before you that will further decrease the use of the hospital. The third one is that Oregon's transformation plan, which was also referred to earlier, is going to have both anticipated and unanticipated ramifications for healthcare resources, including both the utilization of the state hospital and community. And it's impossible to predict the impact of those changes on the need for state hospital beds. And finally, Oregon's efforts to integrate primary and mental health services will also have unanticipated ramifications for health care resources and our budget, including in the state hospital. And so we really just don't have enough information to be able to predict what we're going to need. So to wrap up, the advisory board is, first of all, working very hard on behalf of the people in state hospitals in Oregon. We're very concerned about making sure that we only use those hospitals when everything else has truly failed, earlier intervention, access to treatment, and that means we have to beef up our community systems. We're grateful for the new leadership at the hospital. Mr. Roberts has our confidence and our support, and if you have any questions, we are more than happy to respond.
Thank you so much, Maggie. Appreciate you coming. Were your statements, was that in writing? I mean, is that something
everything,
you can give our staff?
Is it it's not in the same order, but everything I said is in that document.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You bet.
So I know that Representative Hoyle is here. Do you mind if holding on just for a minute? Representative Hoyle and Senator Nelson. Thank you so much, Maggie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you would come on up. Maggie, and just stay right there. Come on up. Representative and Senator, it seems we've already started this debate, which was interesting. And I know that Senator Nelson, you had some experience with the original plan that I think affected folks in your district. And so if you would talk some about that, and then Representative Hoyle, if that would be okay.
Thank you, Chair. My name is David Nelson. I'm State Senator from District 29, includes Pendleton. My district has the Blue Mountain Recovery Center, and so everything that I say is somewhat affected by that because I want to make sure that that institution continues to serve. Yeah, I started on the original concept when Senator Peter Courtney wanted to start was pushing the effort to build the new state hospitals because of the federal band-aids. And that was in 2005 or 2007, I can't remember which. But the difference is now is that times have changed, and we're not flush with money. The big issue we have now is we don't have the money to do all the things we'd like to do. You know, and in a perfect world, we'd have the hospitals being built. We'd have a huge community-based system. You know, at that time, they were talking about 16-bed units was going to be really one of the answers at the community-based level. And but times have changed. We don't have the money. So I think what we have to do is just react to and adjust to that and see what we can work out. You know, our issue really is a taxpayer is not willing to pay more money. The system is demanding a huge more amounts of money. And I guess this is a point where I get to say we got to start using our natural resources so we can raise more money so we can...
Only if everything's off
we're
here.
If you guys are going to get me down here, I get to talk about Columbia River water. You know, at some point. Some way or another, we've got to raise more money for the system, and the taxpayer is probably not willing to pay. So, you know, I could go on and on about a lot of these things, and if there's specific questions you'd like to ask about that whole system, conditions have changed.
I wanted to hear your perspective from Eastern Oregon, because I think you may be the only person here from Eastern Oregon.
Well, we have a person back here.
Mark Webb.
Yeah, okay. And we have two more speakers from Greater Oregon Behavioral.
Well, I hope we'll have time for these
folks.
Okay,
so I'll just shut up.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Paul, I bet you gave them something in writing, gave the staff person, is that right?
I did.
And I'm so happy you did, but I have 15 minutes. Can you sum up, and it sounds we have
several
people.
Yeah, I will. And the testimony that I gave you in writing is not actually what I was going to say. First, I want to my name is Val Hoyle. I represent House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. The testimony that I gave you was from a psychiatric nurse at Peace Health.
Oh.
So it is not the testimony I'm going to give, but I will keep this very short. I do want to thank the co-chair for the donuts, but I gave up dessert for Lent, so thank you for reminding me of the privations I must endure for the next 38 days. The reason that I gave you the testimony from Peace Health, the Johnston unit, is one of the key acute care hospitals for psychiatric needs. What that testimony talks about is the number of people who have to be kept in a short-term hospital setting for longer than they should be kept because there aren't beds in the state hospital. Now, we can discuss whether or not PSRB clients should be in the state hospital at the level they are. We have House Bill 3100 that is working to change the PSRB system so that we can better control the front door. But the fact is that Oregon has 19.2 state hospital beds per 100,000 people. We are 30th. We rank 30th in terms of number of hospital beds per person. And just to put that in perspective, we can have a discussion about whether the right people are in the hospital or the, you know, we don't have the right people there. But at the end of the day, the number of hospital beds that we're looking to increase by building Junction City is 20 beds. If you, and I'm sure you looked at the revised forecast of need for the state hospital, The Portland facility would cost $35 million to upgrade. It is a rental facility. It doesn't make sense to me that we would build up a rental facility. And again, the cost for increased staffing and fixing up Blue Mountain is $27 million and $17 million respectively. So the increase in biennial cost would be $11 million to build Junction City. I am also very proud to have a doctor as our governor, and this doctor and our governor does support the building of Junction City. It is in his budget. He does recognize that we need parity, and I would say that keeping people who are severely mentally ill in prison, keeping people who are severely mentally ill in inappropriate placement, that is not parity, and that is not right. Finally, I would just say that if we look at the amount of time that people have to wait to get into the state hospital, 26% of people wait 8 to 14 days, 23% 15 to 21 days, 22 to 29 days, 25% of the people wait, and then 19% of the people wait over 30 days after they're found severely mentally ill, in need of inpatient treatment, and the beds aren't there. So again, and then I also would like to say that Junction City, although it is a rural area, is very close to Eugene. There is access to jobs. There is access to a working population, education, and many other things. I share a line with Representative Thompson, so he certainly knows the area. I hope that you can support this project, and we can also support community mental health. It's really needed.
Thank you, Representative Hoyle, and thank you, Senator.
Could I just mention this thing?
Yes.
We've got some folks here from, it's called GOBI, Greater Oregon Behavioral Health. It basically takes care of a lot of the things from Eastern Oregon, and they have a lot more information and facts.
And they are a fantastic program.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So, Gina, help me here. We have the county commissioner, and we have Kevin Campbell.
I can help you in about 15 seconds,
all right.
Representative.
All right.
Representative, Chair Tomei and Gilliam, my name is Gina Nickel. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I have a lot to share with you that I think is crucial that you hear. Since I'm a block and a half away, I can come back at any time and talk to you individually or come back here. We have two people, Kevin Campbell and Judge Mark Webb, that have traveled well over 100 miles to be here to talk with you today, and I would request that you bring them up here and give them the remainder of the time.
Thank you, and we will have you back.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, so we have Kevin Campbell and Mark Webb. And thank you all who have come here today, and I'm sorry that we've had to speed this up so much. And we have 11 minutes, gentlemen, so just sit right down and start talking. Identify yourself, please.
You want me to start?
Yes.
My name is Mark Webb. I'm the Grant County Judge. I'm here today just to talk about some things going on in mental health in our county and in our region, in particular the John Day Acute Care Facility. This is a self-contained facility that will provide 4 acute care beds, and acute care beds are for those individuals who are considered a danger to themselves or others. And these beds are for people who we need to stabilize, and then we can put them somewhere else. It'll have 3 secure residential beds for people who are stable but still need secure levels of treatment and a protective environment. It'll have two hospital levels of bed care that we'll provide, and then one community sort of respite for emergency situations where people just need to rest or get out of the community, settle down, stuff like that. I am a little bit nervous. I'm not used to doing it this way. What I want to communicate, though, is the way in which this facility, one, was embraced by our community, two, complements not only mental health but physical health needs in our community and in our region, and then the way in which this kind of facility is a very cost-effective way to provide mental health care region-wide. So that's mostly what I'm here to talk about. And I've essentially
said... And we have
said,
about 2 minutes, because I do have one more speaker, Chris Bonner from
so
Nani.
I don't have much more to say. I mean, we've partnered with the local hospital, complementary services, meets regional needs. I think the thing to appreciate is that the people who are providing the care are, in a sense, also the people who are overseeing the cost. You have the right connection there, so you're incentivizing the right kind of outcomes to provide quality service and save money. That's a model we need at the state level for many of our services that we don't currently have right now. And I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you so much, Mark. Appreciate you coming, especially such a long ways.
Yeah, it is a long ways.
Good morning. My name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Greater Oregon Behavioral Health. Gobi, and Mark, among his other hats, is on my board of directors. Gobi serves 14 rural counties, primarily in Eastern Oregon, but also Clatsop, Columbia, and Douglas County in Western Oregon. We strongly believe that we have to move to a continuum of care that the financial risks or financial incentives are aligned with clinical outcomes. And we also believe, coming from very rural communities as we do, that you solve the problem one person at a time. You don't take on the system. You look at each individual and what best meets their needs. What Mark is talking about in John Day is going to serve 10 people. But those 10 people will be served in a continuum of care that they'll have the same doctor and the same treatment team as they progress through care, and as they migrate back to the community, rather than being bounced about in the system as they are now all over the state, one place to get acute care, another place to get long-term residential care. And then finally, we try to move them into a community, which may have no connection with their home life. So that my discussions about Junction City are, number one, we don't need it, and number two, we can't afford it. And that'll summarize my thoughts on Junction City very quickly. I've handed out a spreadsheet which shows what we project to be the costs of the state hospital system for the coming year, not the coming biennium. We have used the institutional cost care data from 08-09 and moved that forward to show changes that were made because of the Department of Justice staffing increases and a 5% per year increase, which we believe is modest. And we project that the cost of care is $688 a day. On January 1 of 2000 of this year, we had 70 people from the Gobi region that were in the state hospital system. Of those, 13 were eligible for the Aim High program, or civil commitment that Aim High was impacting. That number had been 20 3 months before that. That number today is 7. So in a little over 6 months, we have taken 20 people from the state hospital and reduced that to 7 through the Aim High program. But as I said, that only deals with civil commitment at this point in time. 43 of the people who were in the state hospital on January 1 were PSRB or forensic patients. Gobi, as an organization, is here to tell you today we are willing to step forward and go at risk for the cost of care to state hospitalization, and long-term care, if we can have rules and regulations that will allow that to happen, including forensic care. And the reason for that is on the bottom of the first page. It is absolutely asinine to me that we would spend $15.5 million of general fund on 70 individuals in the state hospital for the coming year. And yet we can buy the Oregon Health Plan benefit for 55,000 Oregonians for $10 million of State General Fund.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate what you're doing.
On the back, I've given scenarios as to how we could reduce the budget by moving to a managed care environment. We can reduce the budget by $2 million of State General Fund and actually bring over almost $6 million of new money into the budget by going at risk for this population. We would like to have an extended conversation about that, but I believe we need to have some leadership in this state that starts from the ground up as well as from the top down.
We heard that in the previous presentation.
We truly believe Gobi has been in business for 15 years now, and we've made it work in the most rural counties in the state. It's questionable whether we'll be in existence after July 1 of 2012 or not, but whatever hat we're wearing, we're deeply committed to solving this problem one person at a time and one county at a time. Thank you
so much, Kevin, and thank you for putting these figures together for
you're
us.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. And Chris, you can tie everything up today. Chris Bonif is with National Association for the Mentally Ill. I just want to remind everybody, this is not a debate about whether or not the second hospital is built in Junction City, so I am sorry that it has seemed to get to that point. Chris, tell us about the National Association for the Mentally Ill.
Sure. Representative Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Chris Bonaf. I represent the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Oregon. We're the Oregon State Chapter. We're a national organization composed of individuals living with mental illness and family members and friends. We're truly a grassroots organization. We have about 1,500 members across the state. Our prime function in life is to deliver programming, free education, and support programs to family members trying to support a loved one with mental illness, whether that be a child, teenager, or adult, or individuals living with illness themselves. We have programs that focus around relapse prevention, health and wellness, and that's really what the heart of what we do. Representative Tomei, to kind of quickly tie this all together, I think what you're hearing are questions about what are we purchasing. Under old models, what we did is we purchased institutions, and we continue to do that. The state hospital, approximately $200,000 a year for X number of beds. A proposed hospital at Junction City, by the state's forecast, would cost us about $290,000 per year per bed. You look at what can be done in the community for much less, and not coincidentally, it can be done better and more effective. I mean, one of the things we do currently at the hospital traditionally is we park people there for years. And if anything, in the children's system that Mr. Harris alluded to, what we learned is that if you put children in institutions for a couple of years, you teach them to be institutionalized. You don't give them the successful tools to live out in the community. That's why the Children's System Change Initiative has been so effective. We've actually downsized the demand for residential care because we have focused more heavily on the community, and we're touching more lives because of that, and consequently getting better outcomes. The quandary is, in the adult system, is you do have what we call forensic patients. You have PSRB folks. You have people who are on aid and assist. We're trying to determine their fitness to proceed in criminal proceedings. And that has, because of that quandary, you have this additional sticking point. So people are at the hospital, they're stuck. Then you go down into our residential care program, and the state commissioned a study from Acumentra that was, I believe, out in the fall, where they found that approximately 60% of the people in our state licensed facilities out in the community could move to more independent living. Now, some people have attacked the methodology of that study, but I find the quote in there that came out of there, they basically couldn't find in our residential system any logical pathway or any logical process that is trying to get people from our state licensed facilities into more independent care. So we have a system that is very, very stagnant. And that's what it really comes down to. I think that if you heard anything today, it should be that we have capacity in our system. We need to use that capacity correctly. So the hospital as a precious resource needs to be used as a hospital. You know, the question ought to be asked, if someone is in the hospital 8 years, is that really the best use of a hospital that is supposed to be a psychiatric acute hospital? If someone is in residential care in a residential treatment facility for several years, is that, are we just doing custodial care at that point? Is there any real treatment going on? Are we moving people to the most independent setting possible? And I think that, as you look at external factors now, looking in, or external eyes looking into our system, you have to take into account that the U.S. Department of Justice is asking that question right now. So we all looked at the U.S. DOJ and CRIPA civil rights within the confines of the state hospital, but they've actually expanded their investigation to the Olmstead Act, which is basically, they're asking the state of Oregon, are you needlessly institutionalizing people? And I think for a lot of us, the answer to that question is now yes, that we know that we have capacity. If we use that capacity right, and we move people through the system, we don't need a new state hospital. We have enough beds. Okay? We need those beds more dispersed. We certainly shouldn't be closing down beds in Portland and Pendleton and moving them elsewhere and cutting off families and individuals from their support networks and their families. No other illness would we ship someone 3 hours away from the metropolitan area or an hour away from the metropolitan area where they reside. And only mental illness is it acceptable to do that and to put it next to a correctional institution. So what we need to do really is through vehicles like House Bill 3100 and the Dash 4 amendments that NAMI proposed, and there's a reason the Oregon Association of Hospitals is supporting that amendment, is just as Representative Hoyle highlighted, hospitals are having a hard time accessing the capacity because there's no movement in the capacity. So if we take these kind of solutions, HB 3100, or Dash 4 amendments, create more movement in that system, create more accountability, and disperse our community services to the communities actually being served, I think we will take a huge leap forward in the quality and, frankly, the quantity of our mental health care here in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thank you all for coming. Thanks for my stalwart members who stayed. I really appreciate it. You did good. Thank you for the good.
And can we thank Vic, too?
Absolutely.
He didn't fit into any of the other categories you mentioned. So
I mentioned the goodies. Wasn't that enough?
That was good. Yeah, that was good.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. We obviously need to have more information here, and we'll have other hearings. Thank you so much. Thank you. Oh, I need to close the hearing, House Human Services.